Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Brista Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Bodega Bay, California.
Archives of the show can be found a week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can reach us for comment at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.
The show is sponsored by Firestorm Books and Cafe, located for now at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm offers organic coffee and milk, vegan baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar.
This week on The Final Straw, we'll be presenting Sean Swain's challenge to current Ohio Governor John Kasich, a conversation with Dane Rossman about his experience of extradition to Canada in relation to the Toronto G20 charges and borders, and finally a conversation with Cece McDonald about her experience of going to prison for the self-defense killing of a white supremacist in the summer of 2011 in Minneapolis. She also talks about her experiences on the inside and about her recent release. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Record like a boss! In 2010, when I ran as a write-in candidate for Ohio governor from prison against John J. Wow Kasich, I demanded a hand recount since write-in votes cannot be tabulated mechanically. I was denied. You know how it is. Those corporate party tyrants all stick together, running naked through the grass behind the Masonic Lodge, sniffing glue and having sex with each other's house pets. But Governor J. Wow Kasich clearly saw me as a threat, so he and his dog-swapping pals in the Ohio General Assembly passed a ban on third-party candidates for governor, just to get rid of me. You know what they always say, if you can't beat them, disqualify them. Well, that failed. A federal court struck down Governor J. Wow's self-serving ban, and that got me back in the 2014 race, and it got Governor J. Wow hiding under his desk again. Then came those nasty rumors. First, that I secretly planned to promote the idea that the internet hacktivist group, Anonymous, should shock the world by boldly compromising Ohio's computer election systems and changing the election results to reflect that I ended up with 100% of the vote. Truth is, I would never have even thought of such an awesome idea, and I have serious doubts that even superhero rock star hacktivists like Anonymous could pull off such a historic theatrical feat. But it would be funny. The second rumor is that I'm encouraging anarchists to migrate to Ohio under the guise of stealing one election, what I call the Million Molotov March, but that, when they get here, I secretly plan to propose that we abandon electoral politics, tip over cop cars, and burn down the state house.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional institution and may be recorded or monitored.
Quite frankly, they make me out to be some kind of diabolical genius. Although they do have a good point that if the Million Molotov March does converge on Ohio, you could toss the dumb election out the window and go straight to rebellion mode. Then came the action figure controversy. After my campaign sent a prototype of the action figure in my likeness, complete with the bushy beard and patented Buddy Holly birth control glasses, to Governor J. Wow's campaign, they made the point of saying that I'm not the first candidate with an action figure. Jesse Ventura had one, too. But I do have the first action figure that's anatomically correct, and they know it. You know they looked. You know they did. So now the televised debates. My campaign has attempted to make arrangements with Governor J. Wow's campaign and the Democrat bankster puppets to have me appear in the debates via Skype from Ohio's Super Duper Max. But wouldn't you know it, Governor J. Wow's yes men keep dodging us. Can't say I blame them, really. If I was a deluded hierarch who outsourced his soul for corporate profiteers' money bags, I wouldn't want to get exposed live on TV by an anarchist I had tortured and silenced either. And by the way, I know how he got his nickname J-Wow. In the moonlight, in the garden, behind the Masonic Lodge, it involved several German shepherds, none of whom were reportedly wearing condoms. And I can't say more. This is a family show. You don't want to encourage that kind of thing. Fireworks are dangerous. So anyway, being kept out of the televised debates, my campaign geniuses came up with a fantastic idea, going public right now. I'm challenging Governor J. Wow to get in the ring. A handicap match. Me against him and his Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor. A no-pinfall, submission-only barbed wire cage match with tabled ladders and chairs to be streamed live at SeanSwain.org from the gymnasium at Ohio Supermax. And to sweeten the deal for Governor J. Wow, before this has even gone public, supporters have pledged $20,000 so far for J. Wow to keep, win or lose, so long as he gets in the ring. It seems this is the match that everybody's been wanting to see. So if you want to see it, sweeten the deal. Send pledges to my campaign manager at mlucas17@kent.edu. That's M-L-U-C-A-S-1-7 at kent.edu. We've already established that Kasich will do anything for money. It's only a matter of establishing a price. So if you want to see me superflex a sitting governor from the top of the turnbuckle, get those pledges rolling in. The money says to keep win or lose. And if he wins, I withdraw from the race and never run again. But if I win, he and the lieutenant governor must relinquish their office to me for just 90 days. 90 days, that's all I'd need. We'd get this party started. You can't hide under your desk forever, Governor Jaywild. Get in the ring. You can get some of what that Mansfield cell extraction team got. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain, write-in candidate for Ohio governor in 2014, and I approve this message.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878, Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
We're speaking with C.C. McDonald, who just got released from the Minnesota Correctional Facility at St. Cloud on January 13, 2014, on charges stemming from a racist and transphobic attack, which occurred in 2012. Would you please introduce yourself for the radio?
My name is Krishan, a.k.a. C.C. McDonald.
For listeners who may not be familiar with your case, could you describe the events of June 2012 that led to your arrest?
I was involved in a racist, transphobic, homophobic altercation that led to the death of one person, Dean Schmidt-Fruel. I stabbed in self-defense.
For your incarceration, what did the support look like for you when you were incarcerated, and like, how did that look for you, and what worked out well and what didn't work out so well?
I can say that the support was really strong and that it was a dual partnership between me and the support committee, and we became really close friends, so that kind of made the support even better because these were people who I confided in, who I talked to, who came to visit me while I was incarcerated. But the support in itself was very strategic. It had a lot of planning behind it. Of course, they were making sure that I were making the best decisions for me and not for the group or what they think or I might think might be good. So they supported me in anything that I did, down from the plea bargaining all the way up until things that were going on inside the prison, like making sure that I had my proper hormones and making sure that I wasn't being discriminated against. So, you know, we worked really hard and long and made sure that we were doing things that were going to be effective and that would have a good outcome.
Is there anything that you would have wished that people did differently? Or do you have any advice for people doing support work for people who find themselves incarcerated?
I wouldn't say that I would change anything. Everything that we did were good ideas that we had came up with as a group and that we thought would be in the best efforts of me and what I thought what would be best for me. So I don't regret anything because we worked hard and we worked long and we made sure that whatever we did, it would have the best outcome and that, you know, me being the person that I am, that I was willing to fight for everything. So I wouldn't change anything. I think as far as other groups that are looking to organize like this, I feel like the first thing that has to be there is a willingness to want to compromise and that there be a collective initiative to want to bring this change. I know that there are a lot of people who are facing the things that I went through. And I say it has to start with the community. You know what I'm saying? Like, the community has to be willing to want to get involved and make sure that injustices and things like that don't happen in their communities. And once people accept that and acknowledge that, then the part about being collective within different organizations, different groups, different community leaders, different people, or just people in the neighborhood who want to get involved need to have a willingness to want to do it and have an initiative to fight it out till it's done. You know what I'm saying? And so for people who want to get into organizing this stuff, I know that people can get in contact with the people who are involved in my support committee for advice, or if you have people come over for meetings and just, you know, invite people to events that are surrounded by the case in which the person is involved, and that way people can network and talk about the case in itself and how to handle the case. And does that person want that type of support and help, and like, and where to move from there? Because I know that that was a lot that happened with my support committee in itself, knowing how to work with all these different people and then how to make the things that we do collective and effective.
Who was primarily running the support for you?
The Trans Youth Support Network. There are different organizations and personal people in my life who, you know, actually are also doing work with me. People who have been knowing me since I've been living up here in Minnesota, like my best friend, Raven, and one of my old caseworkers who became a really close friend of mine, Abby Beasley. So yeah, Raven Cross, she's like my best friend. She's trans too, and I've known her since before her transition, and she's always been my best friend. And Abby Beasley was the one who actually got me in contact, well, got Tyson in contact with me during the process of me. Well, at that time, I didn't know what I was going to do because I didn't have an attorney or anything. So, you know, over time, we've grown to become really good and best friends. And so when she got her news of what had happened to me, she got really involved. She got Tyson involved, and which kind of led to this big movement. And so, yeah, I mean, as the people who are there in my life are still there, the people of the support committee, we've all become really close friends, and getting back into the situation, because I'm still kind of dealing with things and like attached to the incident and attached to being in prison and just being around the people who were there for me during the whole situation and knowing that they're still here, really fantastic.
Do you think that prison support work is something that you'd be interested in doing in the future?
I'm definitely going to get involved. I actually went to a court watch with some people who were there during my trial and making sure that people showed up to court. And I want to people to know within the LGBTQI community and the community that I live in as well, that I will be as supportive to them as they were to me, and making sure that, you know, if I see an injustice or hear about it, I'm going to get involved any way that I can. And even now, like, I'm really wanting to get involved with helping the family of a young man named Terrence Franklin, who got shot by the police, and they didn't get any justice for his death. And of course, the police got off basically with murder again. So I really want to get people involved with that and like get the word out about that and hopefully do more things that are involved with police brutality and injustices as far as, you know, the way people are treated in prisons and jail, and working with different affiliates and different groups to see that there is a change in the criminal system.
That's awesome. If you feel comfortable doing so, could you describe your experiences of incarceration and how were you treated by like COs and peers?
Of course, I was ostracized and treated differently because I was a trans woman in the middle of prison. But, you know, I think the overall issue is that prisons are safe for anyone, and not just for me being a trans woman, but for any person in any prison. There are always issues with that because so much can happen to a person in prison, and the things that happen to a person out of prison, dealing with, you know, having the attachment as felon on you is, you know, really detrimental to a person's life as far as finding work, finding housing, things to keep them out of the cycle of recidivism. So, I mean, I can tell you about all the bad things that I went through, but all of us who work in prisons, we all face those same things. I think it's less about me and my body and me being a trans woman in prison, but I think it's about the negative effect prisons have on people in our community.
I entirely agree. We've been speaking with CeCe McDonald. More after this musical break. You talked about being released. Could you describe your experiences of being released and what are the things that you might have expected and what came as a surprise with that experience?
It's an overwhelming feeling just knowing that the breeze that touches your skin is something totally different than it being in prison. It's just everything is a different experience. And I think people take for granted some things that are so small and minuscule. And I feel like when I walked out, it was just, I can't even explain the feeling. It was just like the world was lifted off my shoulders. And it was just like this different type of fresh air that just really encompassed me and made me feel really good and knowing that, you know, I can be with my family at any time and not have to see them, you know, periodically on a time schedule and in a comfortable environment and it seemed like everyone down your back. And me personally having to just go through the steps of having to just be around the people I love just to have a couple of hours with them and not see them again and do it all over again. It's just, it was really freeing. It was a feeling of certain joy and just, you know, it gets hard after a while because you know that we have to go back to the things, even probably go way back to things, you know, from where you left off, especially for me where I left off going into this system and knowing that nothing is on hold for you and having to come out and just get back accustomed to things. And but I like it, you know, even the small things that people complain about, like paying a bill, I feel happy doing that because I feel like I'm back to my life and not this life that was created for me.
Do you have any advice for people who are being released from prison?
I think a lot of people who get to that point in their sentence when it's about to be over and the anxiety of going back, it was freaking me out for a while knowing that I was going to be back in this world. For me, it was more about being around people, like my trust with people and how am I going to interact. Because having a situation where, and which I'm pretty sure most trans women deal with, but having that situation where you deal with people, strangers on a daily basis, every time you step outside your house and not knowing where. Because in my mind, the first thing I always go back to is that night and, like, I don't want to have to deal with that again, ever again in my life. So I kind of, like, my trust with people are still kind of not in the clear because I don't know how to deal with different people who don't know me now. Like, I don't know how to just talk to a person or, like, even just being on the bus is, like, an anxiety thing for me. Just that incident has, like, mentally put me into a place where I look at people differently. So that was one of my anxieties as coming out. But I think a lot of times people fear like the rejection that comes with being a felon because it's hard to get a job. It's hard to get housing. It's hard to do a lot of stuff when, you know, nobody wants to work with you or no one trusts you because now you have this attachment placed upon you. And you know, then that kind of puts you back in a position as to where it probably landed you in the situation that you're in. So it's like this constant cycle of being in prison, having this anxiety about being out because you know there's, you know, you have to provide for yourself, and for a lot of times these people have to provide for families, their families. And for me, I'm blessed to have such wonderful people in my life who always look out for me. And I know that if I needed a job or if I needed a place to stay or if I needed something like that, that these people are there for me. But a lot of people who come out of prison don't have that. And I hate that the system is so messed up like that, where they would want to keep somebody in this position of dealing with prisons, dealing with that type of anxiety of, you know, not even wanting to come out because you know that you have to provide for yourself and find a way to provide, and no one is willing to give you a chance. And I feel like that's why the cycle keeps continuing, because no one is willing to speak up about how detrimental being a felon is to that person and like having that attachment to them. Like I said, I have people in my life who are willing to work with me and give me things and know who I am as an individual. But if I wanted to apply at a big brand, big name company, it would be hard for me to get a job because they see you as this felon, quote unquote, and they're not seeing you as an individual, even as a hardworking person. So I know what it's like to have those anxieties. For people who are in prison, you know, I can only say to them is to just keep fighting, get involved with these organizations that want to change policies and laws for felons, that want to change the way that we are employed as felons. And just to stay strong. I know it's hard and it's really mentally and physically tiring, but I know that the people who are in prison are strong people. A lot of people that I've met, like, no matter what their vices are, some of these people are really good people and undeserve to be in prison. It's just the way that this country is policed and how we're laws that are unfair to certain races and classes of people, and just it's really, really that this system exists in itself.
Your case was a pretty visible one, it seemed. What factors do you believe contributed to the visibility of your case?
I don't know. I question that a lot because I feel like a lot of times African-American, let alone African-American trans woman, get that type of platform from a case and, you know, have it have so much spotlight, because it's like a lot of times people don't care about what goes on in the hood or what happens to a black person. Or, and as far as being trans, I feel like people just see us as non-existent anyways. For this case to have gotten the spotlight that it did was in itself just incredible. And it, again, with the, you know, the people who were involved outside while I was inside, who did a lot of the work getting that story out there, it's what kind of brought it to this broader spectrum of media and getting people involved. So I can't personally say why, but I feel like it took a lot of hard work and getting people to see that these issues does exist and they affect a lot of people, because the story was so complex, dealing with different social issues as far as the acceptance of trans women in society and how people still deal with homophobia and transphobia, and how certain genders and classes and races are treated differently within the system and outside of the system. Just, it was so much connected to this case that so many people looked at its complexities and then they began to question things about themselves or about society or about the people who they associate with or about the system and how people are affected by the unjust and unfair laws that are placed upon certain people. And I guess people looked at that and wanted to get involved or wanted to understand more about it, or can't understand when something is unfair or unjust, or just want to call somebody out on their bullshit and say, hey, that wasn't fair, or you're wrong. I think that's why so many people get involved. But I don't know what it is that made people want to get involved, because I know there have been cases before mine that were similar, or in some cases would have been worse, because some people see it as me being alive and that I stood up for something. And I think that also just look at people involved, because people got fed up of hearing about trans women being attacked and being killed, and society thinking it's okay or not speaking up about it. And for me to have stood up for myself and for, you know, what I believed in, I think that's what kind of got people involved, because people feel the same way I do. Like, it's time that we not take people's bullshit anymore. Like, we have to be able to defend ourselves and stick up for ourselves and speak for ourselves and not have to live in fear and worry about what the next person is going to say or do to us.
Do you think that the fact that the person who attacked you was, like, he had a Nazi tattoo or, like, a swastika or something, do you think that that maybe contributed to it as well? Or, like, how did that influence it,
at all? There were so many complexities, and race being one of them, it's what got a lot of people involved. And knowing that people still exist in this day and age where people say everyone is so tolerant of each other, and that racism doesn't exist, or homophobia doesn't exist, or transphobia doesn't exist, whatever, it's all a bunch of bullshit. Like, it exists, and that was a physical incarnation of hatred. If a person has a swastika tattoo on their chest, that pretty much tells you about that person. I'm not going to think that this person was friendly or wanted to sit down and have tea or anything. Like, this person had a swastika tattoo on their chest, and that meant something to that person for them to get that type of symbol, you know, placed on their being. Like, you know, I would never get a tattoo that says kill straighty or anything unless if it had some significant meaning. And knowing that, like, who got really upset because it was so obvious who this person was, and they didn't want to admit these things in court, and people got frustrated with that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, super, super fucked up thing. And like you said, it's super, super complicated, and it's difficult to say and how things were being treated and, like, how people interacted with your case. And I guess, like, on that point, I wanted to ask you if during your experience of the event and during your incarceration and with support, did you, because of your race or your gender, feel tokenized by support crew or media? And if so, in what ways did that inform your experience?
I am a statistic that it was out of my hands at that point. I am the face of the reality of African American trans women and the communities we live in. Like, it wasn't that I was being tokenized. It was just reality. It's what it is. I'm a African American trans woman, and I'm likely to get targeted more than anybody else in the world. So it's like, in this case where so many other African-American trans women and trans women of color in general have been murdered, and for me to have beaten one of those odds is like, it can come off a little bit, I'm surrounded by all this media and all these, you know, white people, but this is the reality. You know what I'm saying? Like, everybody who got involved were from all different types of races and, you know, whatever. But the reality is, I am who I am. You know what I'm saying? I'm black, and I'm a trans woman, and it so happened that a lot of black or trans women of color are targeted. I mean, I also tokenized. I mean, it was just the reality of what it was.
Is support for you and your case ongoing? And, like, is it continuing on? And what sorts of support do you need right now or want from, like, the people in your community or people who might not be like directly in your community, and how might receiving that support work best for you?
Like I told you earlier, everyone who get involved, we've all become very close and have a different type of friendship now, because there isn't any burden of worrying about the trial or things that had to deal with that. So the people who I've been associated with since the case, we've all stayed very close and we stay in contact. A lot of people have moved out of state, and of course I have my family. But the support, of course, is still there. People are still writing me and like hitting me up on Facebook and just giving me words of encouragement and telling me that I encourage them and inspire them, which again, like I said, everything in my life I feel is a two-way street. You know, whatever I give out, I get back, and vice versa. So I try to give words of support. I try to be someone who can encourage and inspire people and want to do better for themselves and want to be able to speak out and want to be able to make a change in this world. So, but everyone who's involved are still involved. People are still, you know, being supportive of my case. Even afterwards, those people just want to let me know that they support me and whatever, you know, happened, and like they're proud and glad that I chose to defend myself and that I wouldn't have to be another person remembered. And it's really comforting to know that I have people around like that.
Hell yeah. And so like people writing you still and like writing you Facebook messages and stuff, that works pretty well for you as like words of encouragement from your community?
Everybody in general, just people who walk past me and say hi or whatever. Like that's the person that I've always been. Like I've always been a positive, uplifted person, and I try to give that back. So knowing that I had that throughout everything is a true blessing, and I'm really, really happy to know that I have all these people in my life.
Word. That's awesome. Cece, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been really good talking with you about your experiences and what you've been through and stuff.
You too, hon. Thank you for having us interview with me.
We've been speaking with Cece McDonald about her experiences of support and incarceration. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Bodega Bay, California.
We're speaking with Dane Rossman. Dane Rossman was extradited to Canada from the U.S. in early 2013. Dane was arrested and released during the 2010 G20 protests in Toronto. His extradition for property destruction eventually led Dane to take a non-cooperating plea deal with the Canadian government, serving one day in jail and having to pay a restitution of $1,500. And you were released in July of 2013. Thanks so much for joining us on the phone.
Yeah, absolutely.
In February of this year, three other U.S. extradites, Richard Morano, Jill Bitar, and Kevin Chianella, were sentenced by the Canadian government for charges related to the anti-G20 protests. Can you talk about their cases a bit and reasons for the disparities in the sentencing between them?
I don't want to speak a ton about the other cases, but I do know that from the get-go, I was facing the least number of charges. I only had three counts to begin with. I know Kevin Chianella had the largest number of counts, which was, I think, 54 to begin with. He pled recently to, I think, half as many charges and was sentenced to 24 months. And he's apparently the only G20 prisoner who's going to be held in a federal facility in Canada. So that's the largest discrepancy in terms of the length of sentences. In terms of how long it took for their sentences to come about, my case was somewhat unique in that I was the only person facing extradition who didn't waive extradition early on. That is to say, I didn't voluntarily go to Canada. Like, we went through the whole extradition process while I was being held here in Arizona, which was in large part because we knew that I had very few charges and knew very early on what the prosecutor in Canada was looking for, and that I was likely only facing something like 4 months. And on top of that, the judge here in Arizona consistently refused to grant me bail down here. So we made the decision that I would just sort of do as much time as I could down here in Arizona while fighting the extradition, knowing that it would count towards a relatively short sentence once I ended up in Canada.
I think it was Richard Morano had gone through and apologized and written like an apology letter to the cop who had been in the car that he had attacked, allegedly. And I'm wondering, how much, in your opinion, was the sentencing due to evidence, and how much of it was due to people being apologetic or not being apologetic? For instance, Joel Bitar made a statement justifying why he had participated in the G20 protest, at the same time also apologizing at the end for any fear that he had induced into people who were present.
I'm sure that those apologies maybe helped somewhat with the judge, but the sentencing agreements are agreed on between like people's lawyers and the prosecutor before those statements are made. You know what I mean? I'm sure it helps somewhat, but you can also see a huge discrepancy in like the number of charges people were facing to begin with. There was a fifth extradition person named Quinn McCormick, who is also only facing three charges like mine. He seems to be mostly just wanting to like get this out of the way and isn't pursuing the same kind of political defense or like political support that the rest of us have. I think it would be really interesting to see how his case is resolved with like that difference.
But he hasn't been sentenced yet?
As far as I know, no. He waived extradition, I think, for anyone else, I think, in days after being arrested in February of 2013. And he, like, hasn't really been in touch with folks. I think he just wants to get this out of the way, you know?
Yeah.
But I think the result of his case would speak a lot to your question.
Can you talk about what brought you to participate in the 2010 anti-G20 protests in Toronto? What did and does the G20 mean to you?
In 2010, I had already been, for several years, doing a lot of work in, like, No Borders movements. And I was particularly attracted to the No Borders and migrant justice angle of the mobilizations in Toronto. I had for a long time admired the No One Is Illegal network in Canada, who took like a leading role in a lot of the organizing against the G20. And I was like very interested in seeing how they operate on the ground. And they did take a leading role in some of the more confrontational actions up there.
So y'all were arrested and released in Canada during the ruckus in Toronto, and then re-arrested afterwards. Are you aware of what sorts of surveillance technologies the state and private sector were employing during the protests? In Richard Morano's case, apparently masking up wasn't enough.
Yeah. It was a combination of massive surveillance on the part of the Toronto police, and also a large number of like citizen snitches. There were like the Toronto cops set up a Facebook page after the mobilization and received like thousands of photographs from just citizen photographers. The combination of those two and also human error led to a situation where locking up didn't totally serve its purpose. We do know that there was surveillance in the days before the summits that they then like later used to compare clothing to people wearing boots, body frames, things like this. I know that they specifically said the fact that Joel Bitar is so tall is the way that they were able to help identify him, things like this.
Fatima, who spoke about your case on our show last March, listed off conditions you faced that were comparable between your detention and those of immigrants in the U.S., such as being torn away from your community, being held in a CCA or Corrections Corporations of America prison, and being imprisoned alongside of a lot of folks who are facing charges for illegal reentry. But your experience must have been quite different from what most of the immigrants in detention faced. Can you describe your incarceration and how it differed from those around you?
Yeah, absolutely. I was held in Florence, Arizona, in a facility run by Corrections Corporation of America. It was very interesting for me being held there, as the prison population was probably something like 80 to 90% Mexican, the vast majority of those being held on immigration charges. And a number of them had gone through a program called Operation Streamline, which happens in Tucson. This program was first implemented in 2006. And what it does is every day, roughly 70 people who are apprehended by Border Patrol in the desert, rather than being immediately deported south, instead are brought to Tucson and charged criminally for either unauthorized entry or, if they have prior deportations, unauthorized reentry. If it's unauthorized entry, that could carry a sentence of, like, you know, normally around 60 days. If it's reentry, then it can get longer. And if it's somebody who has prior criminal charges, then it could be substantially longer. But everyone who goes through that program ends up in the facility where I was held. And I was often, when I had court dates in Tucson, transported back to the facility with the streamlined defendants, with people who had just gone through the program. And it's a mass hearing, like all 70 defendants will be tried at once. There's very little access to legal counsel, things like this. But it was interesting for me because I had been, to a certain extent, helping organize against this program before, like going in and seeing that on the inside. There's still organizing going on to end the streamlined program. Last October, there's a really exciting action in Tucson where folks blocked both the federal courthouse where the hearings take place and the bus that was transferred, two buses rather, that were transporting people to the courthouse. They successfully stopped almost all the defendants from getting to Streamline. It was the first time that the hearing's ever been canceled. So it effectively stopped around 60 people from doing any amount of prison time. They were rather deported immediately, which is hard to call a success, but it did stop them from doing prison time. Right now there are 16 people facing felony charges for blocking the bus, and 6 people, I believe, are facing felony charges for the courthouse blockade. People should check out endstreamline.org for more information on that campaign and how to support the people facing charges for that action. And in terms of spending time with people in on immigration charges, one of the main things that I often worry about in terms of like doing time in jails or prisons in the U.S. and especially in Arizona is the possibility of negative repercussions from Nazis or organized white supremacists. It was actually, for me, very good to be held in a facility that was almost entirely Mexican, and where the instant that I told people what I was there for and about like the anti-border work that I do, people were like down immediately. So it actually made time a lot easier for me to do being in that context.
That must have been quite a like educational experience, or not educational necessarily, but at least a great opportunity for at least having lots of conversations about people's experience.
Oh yeah. I mean, the work that I've done has always been sort of on the other end of that process, like doing direct aid work in the desert and meeting people before they're apprehended. They had tons of conversations with folks who had like just crossed the desert about like things like specific locations, things like that, that we could talk about. There's like a remarkable amount of like strength and resilience on people's parts in there, considering what they had gone through. Also something that's happening a lot right now in the past 6 years, since deportations have gone up so much under Obama, is that a large number of people crossing the deserts aren't migrating for the first time, but have like been removed from the country and are trying to get home. So a lot of people did have longer sentences for reentry offenses, including people who had prior criminal records maybe, so were facing much longer sentences, something like between like a year, 5 years, people who like worst case scenario could be something for like 10 years, or somebody who had a reentry conviction but also had like a DUI conviction, things like that.
That really testifies to the pull that a sense of home has for people, that they would, this border's there, this legal system's there, and it's going to prosecute someone for prior convictions, and yet they're still willing to try to get past that and push past that to get back to their family or get back to their community where they've been living.
There was this absolute sense that it was kind of like they were aware of the risks and they knew that it like came with the territory of what they were going to do.
What precedents do you feel might come from your extradition and sentencing for participation in protest across borders in terms of how in the future large summit protests end up being dealt with by states?
When I was first taken in, which is actually 1 year ago today, the day that we're recording it, is when they raided, I had a lot of like sort of in hindsight, paranoid thoughts that it was like extremely targeted. This came out a lot from thinking about the ways that the Canadian state targeted people after the G20, especially people who existed at sort of the intersection between anarchist movements, migrant justice or no borders movements, and indigenous sovereignty or indigenous solidarity and land defense movements. So like people who sort of existed at the intersection of those three tendencies. And that's an intersection that we've been working on a lot in Arizona as well. So there was a lot of feeling early on that like that could have been targeted for that reason, because those sort of three poles working together is necessarily threatening to the state, I think, for a lot of reasons. As time went on, it seems less that that's the case, and I get the impression that this is much more the Toronto Police Department sort of throwing a temper tantrum. They were embarrassed by the fact that a mobilization that aimed to, like, I think the language that was used for the Get Off the Fence march was, like, to embarrass the security infrastructure, and it was wholly successful at that, and I think that the Toronto cops are really throwing a temper tantrum, and that's really where this is coming from. So I'm not 100% sure what kind of precedent this totally sets for other kinds of mobilizations. I'm not sure.
How can listeners who are out there support the extradites that have been put into prison that are serving sentences currently up in Canada for G20 participation?
I think definitely writing them letters. They're all being held right now at Toronto West Detention Center. They're all going to be moved shortly, so I'm not sure. So it might make sense at this point to, like, hold off on a more permanent address. Also, I know that Richard Murano has, I think, $3,000 in restitution that he needs to pay, so there's certainly, like, fundraising needs for all three, but especially for that restitution. I know that Guelph ABC is sort of coordinating legal supports to them right now. So going to their website, which I believe is guelphabc.noblogs.org, is a good way to do that. Also, if folks want to mail them books and things like that from the U.S., it might make more sense to coordinate that with Guelph ABC just because of shipping costs.
Thanks a lot for talking to us. Really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. And I appreciate it also.
We've been speaking with Dane Rossman, an anarchist doing anti-border work out of the southwest of the U.S., about his experiences of imprisonment in the U.S. and extradition to Canada in relation to charges of participation in the G20 protests of 2010 in Toronto. To keep up on the sentencing of the extradites and where they can receive mail, check out notorontog20extradition.wordpress.com. That's notorontog20extradition.wordpress.com. Now let's hear Ms. Moore, the Portland, Oregon-based doom and drone band from their January 2014 split with Hell. This track is called Epistemological Rupture. Have a great week.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Brista Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Bodega Bay, California.
Archives of the show can be found a week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can reach us for comment at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.
The show is sponsored by Firestorm Books and Cafe, located for now at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm offers organic coffee and milk, vegan baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar